You can't let yourself get worked up, okay?
Dad rubbed at his wrists again, like he couldn't remember if something was supposed to be there.
Dad,
Daniel said,
it's important.
I leaned forward, spreading a napkin on Dad's lap. Dad, everything's fine. He stared at Daniel.
Promise me,
he said.
Promise me you'll take care of her.
Daniel already had food in his mouth. Nothing could kill his appetite. He kept his eyes on Dad.
You know I will,
he said as he chewed. Karen Adelson came in with the doctor.
How's everything going in here? Patrick, are you feeling better?
What? Oh, yes. Yes.
He grabbed his sandwich like he was playing a part.
This is my daughter. Have you met? Nick, meet the lady in charge. Lady in charge, meet my daughter.
Nice to meet you, both Karen and I said.
Now, Patrick, Karen went on, how about we sleep this off? Have your lunch and the doctor will give you something. We'll discuss this tomorrow, okay?
I nodded encouragingly. Daniel nodded. Dad looked between the two of us and nodded until she left the room. He gripped my wrist.
Promise me, Nick.
I promise, I said. I had no clue what he was asking or what I was agreeing to. I had a feeling it was better for us that way. Karen met us back at the front desk.
We'll assess him tomorrow. Determine the best course of action. Let's plan on meeting again next week.
She handed me her card. We'll be in touch. Daniel and I remained silent, one foot in front of the other. Goodbye to the receptionist. Thank you to the man holding the door, until we were back in the overheated car, driving with the windows rolled down until the air conditioner kicked in. What the hell was that about? I asked.
Hell if I know,
he said, both hands circling the steering wheel, the afternoon sun reflecting off the pavement like water. Did you really tell him about Annalise, or was that just the first thing you could think of?
No,
he said.
I really did.
That wasn't smart.
No, it really wasn't.
He sighed, his hard-to-read expression even more impenetrable. You were wrong to do that, I said. The pink was creeping up his neck as his knuckles blanched white, like the blood was seeping from one spot to the other.
I am fully aware of that, Nick. Fully. I'll come back tomorrow to check on him.
Okay, I said. What time? He cut his eyes to me, then back to the road.
Don't worry about it. Get some work done around the house. I'll bring him the listing papers.
The house isn't ready. His jaw tensed.
That's why you should stay home.
So much for my momentary swell of emotion for him. This was how we always communicated, in the things we didn't say. We had developed a habit after our mother got sick, fighting in the space between words about anything other than what we meant. He was with me the day I scratched Tyler's truck with the swing of my passenger side door, the day we met for real.
You never pay attention,
Daniel had screamed, slamming the driver's side door. You parked too close, I'd yelled back as Tyler looked on. Nothing about the list of things that needed to be voiced, our dad's growing distance, the fact that Daniel was dropping out of school, about what would happen to us after Mom died. No, we argued about how close we parked to other cars, about scraped metal and whether I was running late or he was early. This was how we got through. This was the story of me and Daniel.
I already called out of work for the day, he said. I'll lend you a hand. Make some progress.
The meaning underneath, that I had not made any on my own. I saw it first, that things were not how I'd left them. I stood in the entrance, unmoving, as Daniel brushed by me. He came in, I said. Daniel spun around.
What? Who?
I slammed the door and leaned against it, my breath coming too fast. That cop. He came in the fucking house. I pointed to the dining room table, scattered with chaos, but my chaos. I'd been sorting things into boxes, not by item, but by time period. Things from my childhood, newer things that I'd never seen, and things I could tie to the memory of 18, to when Corinne disappeared, and the items I wasn't sure scattered across the top of the table. but those items weren't grouped how I'd left them. Things had been rifled through and moved. The home renovation book that I'd found in the kitchen drawer, dog-eared and left on the table, now open to the marked page when I'd left it shut. Receipts with the dates worn off reshuffled into the wrong piles.
How can you tell? This place is a mess.
He was here, Daniel. Things have been moved. I swear it. His eyes met mine and we stared at each other, into each other, until he said,
"Check the house."
I nodded and took the steps two at a time to my room. If the cop was looking for signs about Tyler, shouldn't he have checked here? But the room was just as I'd left it, even the top drawer that I hadn't closed in my rush to speak to the cop. Dad's room was mostly bare, and the closet was sparse. Slippers on the floor, empty metal hangers, a few work clothes. But Daniel's room, the one with Dad's old things, had been searched. Boxes moved and stacked, papers left out, without any attempt to hide it. I heard Daniel's footsteps coming up the stairs, down the hall, and then I could hear his heavy breathing over my shoulder.
"What is it?"
he asked. "Here. Someone's been through here," I said. Daniel looked at the mess, his old room, our father's mess.
"Not someone looking into Tyler, then,"
he said. "No," I said. Daniel placed his hand against the door jamb too gently. Since the fair, he never slammed his fists into walls or kicked at the ground or his car, lest somebody see him do it, see a pattern. But he was trying too hard, spilling outside his skin, holding himself too still. He spun silently and went back downstairs. I followed, watching him check the windows, pushing until he was sure the lock was in place.
"Did you lock up?"
He turned on me.
"Because there's no sign of forced entry, Nick."
"I did," I said slowly, "but the back door lock is broken." His eyes widened, and he mumbled under his breath, striding through the kitchen, checking for himself. He pulled on the handle, and it gave, just like I said it would. "I told you," I said, hands on my hips. His hand was on the knob, twisting, twisting, in case there might be a different outcome.
"It was broken before? Before you got here?"
"Yes."
"Are you sure?"
"Am I sure? Yes, I'm sure, Daniel. God!" His face had turned so red with the anger he was holding in that it started to go the other way, blotchy spots of white breaking up the rage.
"Why the hell didn't you say anything? Why didn't you get it fixed? What the hell are you even doing here?"
"What difference would it make? Come on, Daniel. Is a stronger lock going to stop someone determined to get in?" "Be rational. Be calm." Everett's words, but they were useless in my family. This was how we worked.
"No, Nick, but it would be proof. A broken window, fingerprints on the glass."
"Oh, give me a break. Nobody's going to waste resources on a home break-in for a house we're not living in where nothing went missing. They'll blame it on kids. Nobody cares."
"Oh, somebody cares,"
he said. I swallowed, took a deep breath, tried to focus, searching for a reasonable explanation. "Maybe it was Tyler," I said. "He still has a key from years ago." Daniel made a deep sound in his throat, though I didn't know if it was for me or for Tyler. "Maybe he was going to fix the air conditioning, and maybe..." Daniel threw his hands up, took a step closer.
"What? He got distracted by piles of junk and wasted his day going through Dad's things in my old room?"
"Asshole," I mumbled. I flipped the switch in the foyer to check the air conditioning, because, God, if I didn't want it to be true. The other possibilities nauseated me, made me feel like someone had poked that box in the police station too hard, and it had sprung a leak, and the names were circling, caught up in a whirlwind, vicious and desperate. Tyler was the only answer that was safe. Please be Tyler. I turned the AC dial down and listened to the walls. Nothing. No catch. No whoosh. No rattling vents. Daniel's knuckles were white. He was right beside me, and his voice was eerily low.
"Tyler works. He doesn't need to sneak around or use a key when we're out. I'm sure he can talk his way in here pretty easily. Bet he doesn't even have to talk."
I pushed him in the chest, gently, just for space. Another inch. So we were going to fight about Tyler again. That, at least, was an argument we knew the lines of already.
"He'd call first,"
he said.
"Did he call you?"
At my silence.
"Did he?"
"No, but we're not..." "He's not really talking to me right now." Daniel let out a bark of laughter.
"Unfucking believable. You've actually done it, Nick. You've pissed off the one person who seemed immune. You've finally gone too far. Congratulations."
"You're an asshole, and you're so fucking stupid sometimes, it's infuriating." He stared at me, and I stared back, my head tilted to the side, his cheeks bright red, his neck splotchy, his fists balled up, something dark and ugly coursing through my veins. "Are you going to hit me now?" I asked. He breathed heavily, furiously, and whatever fragile ground we stood on, shattered. One question, creating so much distance between us yet pulling us right there, his knuckles colliding with my cheek and the beginning of the end of everything. Daniel walked around me in a wide berth. He left the front door ajar. I slouched against the wall, cradling my phone to my chest. This place messed with me, made me forget myself. I called Everett, but his cell went to voicemail. I called the office and kept my voice practiced and steady as I talked to the secretary, Olivia, who'd become one of my closest friends. A tied-to-Everett friend, but a friend. "He's prepping witnesses," she said. "I'd love to chat, but this place is falling apart this week. Can you hear that?" And I could. The ringing phones in the background, the low hum of voices. She went on. "Jesus Christ, I need a girls' night so bad. When are you coming back?" "Shit, I gotta go. I'll tell him you called." I stared at my phone, wondering whom to call to ground myself. The truth is, I'm not good at close friends. I'm great at casual, at meeting up after work and bringing lasagna to the potluck. I'm excellent at being friends with Everett's friends, but not at exchanging numbers and calling up just to talk. I always leave people behind. Holiday greeting cards last one apartment, and then I move. No forwarding address. Emails go unanswered, phone calls unreturned. It's a habit. It's easier. I'm the friend in the group they'll throw a going-away party for, but never keep in touch with. I had ladder rungs to climb, debts to repay, a life to create. And whom did I have after so many moves? Everett for a year. My college roommate Arden, but she was a doctor and busy, and every decision she made was life or death, which made everything I said seem trivial. My thesis advisor Marcus. I could call him, vent my issues in a normal way, surface level. Not like this. My best friend disappeared when I was 18, and it's all coming back, and I'm losing my dad, and someone's been in this house. Maybe the cops, but maybe not. They were the people you called with news. I met a guy. I'm engaged. I got a new job. To share the highs and the lows. But friends to call for the deep things, the things that live in the dark spaces of our hearts, those people didn't exist for me any longer. Not since I'd left Cooley Ridge. Everett called back at night when I was cleaning the house, guilted into action by Daniel's disapproval. I heard voices in the background, fading as he walked away.
"Hey, sorry. I thought it was earlier. You weren't sleeping, were you?"
"Nope," I said. "What's going on there?"
"Boring legal stuff. Boring but relentless."
He sighed.
"I miss you. How's it going with the filing?"
"Papers have been submitted and we're waiting for a court date. Working on the house. How's the case?"
"Oh, you know. Be glad you're not here. I'm still at the office. You'd be furious."
I checked the clock, saw that it was nearly 10. "I'd show up and bring you dinner."
"God, I miss you."
And then another voice. A woman's. Mara Cross.
"Hold on,"
he said. His hand was over the speaker.
The pad thai. Yeah, thanks."
Then to me.
"Sorry, we're ordering food."
"Mara's there?" I asked.
"Everyone's here,"
he said, not missing a beat. Everett had a painfully healthy relationship with his ex. At least he thought so. But her smile was too forced when she looked at me, and everything about her was too stiff when she walked by him, knees to shoulders to neck. They weren't really friends, despite what Everett wanted to believe. Olivia couldn't stand Mara, the way she talked down to her and then to me. It's probably how we became friends. I'd asked Everett ages ago why he and Mara had broken up, because she was always smiling and attractive and smart and there.
"We weren't compatible,"
he'd said, which made no sense to me at first. They seemed perfectly compatible, equals even. She had strong opinions and worked even longer hours than he did, and they could talk about the same things, torts and motions and appellate courts, words that I understood but that held no real meaning for me. I liked to imagine they were incompatible in some other way, in bed. Whenever I saw her, whenever I caught her looking at Everett like she knew him too well, I held tight to the word incompatible, picturing something awkward and unsatisfying. Her name became synonymous with this vision, and I found myself legitimately surprised when she won cases. Her? She's so awkward. Her arguments so unsatisfying. Easier than to think that I must be none of those things. Strong, opinionated, dominating in a room. Otherwise, we would not be compatible, or so goes the logic. What did he see in me? Someone he could mold, create, introduce and place in his world exactly like he wanted? What did he see in the painted furniture and the long conversation in Trevor's apartment? A blank slate? "You have to come from nothing," I'd told him. Maybe he took it too literally. He didn't know I was already something. I knew things about Everett the same way he knew things about me, from what he chose to share, or what his family shared in a ha-ha remember the time way. Where were his skeletons? He had friends, guys mostly, who varied in degrees of never growing up, which was obnoxious but not harmful, not haunting, not defining. They'd tell stories of Everett doing keg stands and that one time he swallowed a goldfish whole, which was repulsive but not the same as a missing best friend and a family of suspects. If Corinne had never disappeared, maybe we'd meet up for drinks when we were all back in town, share stories like this with our boyfriends, our husbands. And then Bailey puked on Josh Howell's sneakers. There was a difference, a chasm between that type of story and a real past. Did something like this exist beneath Everett, too? Where were the stories that defined him, that broke him open and laid him bare? Who was this man I had agreed to marry? "Tell me something about you," I said. "Something no one else knows." I heard his chair squeak as he leaned back. I imagined him sliding his feet out of his shoes and placing them on the dark wood, stretching his arms up over his head, the buttons of his shirt pulling, the outline of his bleach-white undershirt beneath.
"Is this a game?"
he asked, and I could hear the yawn in his voice. "Sure," I said, "or it doesn't have to be."
"Okay, let's see." "Okay, don't laugh. I tried to use my dad's credit card in middle school to buy porn online. It didn't occur to me that his statements would have the purchased information."
"That's gross," I said, laughing, "but it doesn't count. Your dad knows."
"Ugh, don't remind me. Still can't look him in the eye when I think about it."
"You're cute, but that's not what I meant. I meant something more, you know, that nobody else knows." His chair squeaked a few more times, and I didn't think he'd answer, but then he did.
"I watched a man die once," he said.
The air in the room changed. His voice dropped, and I felt his mouth coming closer to the phone.
"I was in high school. There was a car accident on the highway, and I wasn't supposed to be out. There was a crowd of people already around helping, an ambulance on the way. I couldn't look away."
"Yes," I thought. "Here he is. Here's Everett. Can he feel it?" "More," I said. A deep breath. I heard footsteps, a door closing, the squeak of his chair again. I didn't dare interrupt.
"I don't know if I have the stomach for my job," he said. I like dealing in the facts and the law, and I believe that everyone is entitled to the best representation, a fair trial. I do my job well, don't get me wrong. But sometimes there's a moment when you realize the person you're defending is guilty, and you can never go back. And then justice is this double-edged sword, like I'm upholding justice with my unyielding drive, to quote my dad. But which is the real justice, Nicolette? Which is it?
The Parlito case?
Just anyone,
he said. He sighed.
I'm a better lawyer when I don't know.
You can do something else, I said.
It's not that easy,
he said. Yes, it is, I said. I don't care what you do. You know that, right? I don't give a shit if you're a lawyer or not. He paused.
Right, if you say so. We don't all have that luxury. I'm 30. I'm a partner. This is my life.
What I'm saying is, it doesn't have to be. Change your hair. Leave everyone behind. Go someplace new and never look back. You can do it. We can do it. He laughed as if mocking himself, putting distance between himself and the conversation.
So tell me, Nicolette, did you always want to be a counselor?
No way. I wanted to be a country singer.
Wait,
he said.
You can sing? I feel like this is something I should know.
Not even a little. His laugh was soft, like cotton. Truth is, I was a terrible counselor in terms of actual counseling. Said the wrong things, never had the right advice to give. But I excelled at listening, so I learned not to speak much. I could direct students to the right resource or the resource to them to find the help they needed. I saw what they were hiding and let them show it to me. They spilled their collective adolescent guts in my office. On paper, I was an excellent counselor. Perhaps it was because they sensed a kindred spirit or saw something inside me like what I saw in Hannah Pardo. The feeling that she knew more because she was one of us. Maybe they knew I had seen darker things, that I would understand. Or perhaps they would sense that I am an excellent keeper of secrets. I am. I ended the call when Everett's dinner arrived, already feeling he was unreachable, in a world too far away. With Tyler, it had been the opposite. I'd had to delete his number from my phone to keep from calling him on impulse after a drink at the bar, after a bad date, and especially after a relatively good one. But 1 second off the phone with Everett, and all I could feel was the distance between us, and him turning insubstantial, a figment I had conjured up out of hope that something so good could happen to me. I slept fitfully until I gave up, too many thoughts swirling through my mind. Too many names. I thought of anyone who'd have a reason to break into this house, to look through Dad's things or to rifle through Daniel's old room. The list spanned 10 years. I wasn't sure I was solving what had happened then or what had happened now. Maybe Dad was right, that time wasn't real, just a thing we created to move on, just a label to make sense of things. If I were a monster, Corinne had told us on the front porch with the lantern swinging and the shadows dancing, I'd pretend to be human. Bailey had laughed and Daniel had smiled. She'd walked up to him, taking his chin in her hand, turning his head side to side, squinting as she stared into his eyes. No, she said to him, human, through and through. She looked at Bailey next, running her fingers through her long black hair as she did it. Which was because Daniel was there, and she always put on a show. Her nose touched Bailey's, and Bailey didn't flinch. We'd learned to let her have her way. Go along for the ride, and it turns out all right. There's a plan that only Corinne knows, and we're a part of it. She said.
No, not here. But he's been here. He visits sometimes.
What does he make you do, Bailey? Does he make you kiss other people's boyfriends? That was you, Corinne, I thought but didn't say. Neither did Bailey.
Does he make you like it?
Her hand was on Bailey's back, under her shirt. Her body pressed to Corinne's, and Daniel's eyes had gone dark and hazy, under a spell.
Does he make you dream of him at night?
of boys who aren't yours. She stepped back, breaking the spell. Bailey blinked twice, and Daniel walked into the house. Corinne smiled like nothing had changed. She took my chin, looked deep into my eyes. I could see myself reflected in her pupils from the lantern swinging overhead. She blinked and pressed her cheek against mine, facing away from Bailey, and whispered in my ear, "There you are." The day before. Day 8. Now that we'd emptied the garage, I could see why Daniel had tried to convert it years earlier. Windows on both sides and light streaming through, exposed beams inside a steepled roof, a corner tucked away for storage that would be perfect for a bathroom. I stood at the entrance, staring at the unfinished walls, lost in my memory of Daniel and Dad, Tyler and his father, working together out here in the early June mornings 10 years ago, before everything changed. The low rumble of an engine cut off, and I backed out of the garage.
"Nick?"
A deep voice called from across the yard, one I didn't recognize at first. It tickled my memory, pulling at threads while I tried to place it. I spun around to find a man down by the road, sliding off a motorcycle, the sun behind him, his face in shadows. I walked toward him, my hand shielding my eyes until he became less shadow, more person. Where his sleeves ended, dark writing began, scripted and curling all the way down his thumbs. "Jackson?" I asked, still too far to see his face. He nodded.
"Yeah. Hey. Hi. Sorry to drop by like this. I'm looking for Tyler."
"He's not here." I stood at the edge of the road and watched as the words on his arm seemed to ripple when he ran his hand through his shaggy brown hair. Erase the tattoos, crop the hair, change his clothes, and he was classically all-American. Strong jaw and defined cheekbones, broad shoulders, lean frame. There was a reason he was Corinne's. Just one version nested inside another now. He had a tremor in his left hand as he brought a cigarette to his mouth, assessing me through the smoke.
"You sure?"
he asked. I rolled my eyes. "Do you see his truck?" I looked over my shoulder, cupped my hands around my mouth. "Hey, Tyler, you here?" I turned back to face him, the smoke more pungent now. "I'm sure."
"It's not a joke,"
he said.
"I've been looking for him, and I'm not the only one. Haven't seen him since Friday."
And today was Monday, 7 days since Annalise was reported missing. "What makes you think I have?" The heels of his black boots dug into the dirt as he leaned against his bike.
"I work at a bar, Nick, where people talk. A bar that Tyler lives above."
"I haven't seen him, Jackson. I swear it. Not since Friday." He paused, shifted his feet in the loose dirt where the road met the grass.
"I can hear his phone from inside his apartment, and I don't want to call the police. I don't think that would be such a good idea, but I was wondering if maybe you had a key? Just to check."
My stomach turned hollow. I hadn't seen Tyler in 3 days, hadn't heard from him at all. I'd thought of many possible reasons for him not showing up in the last few days, but until that moment, none of them had anything to do with his safety. "I don't have a key," I said. "I used to, and then he moved. I was already backing up to the house to get my car keys. Let me just grab my purse." Jackson nodded.
"Yeah,"
he said. At 9 a.m. on a Monday morning, the bar was closed, which I was glad for. Jackson had implied that there were enough rumors already. "His truck is gone," I said, standing in the gravel lot behind the bar. I looked up at the window, the blinds pulled shut.
"I know. It's been gone all weekend. But the phone..."
"No, you're right," I said.
"I can call the landlord, but I don't want to leave Tyler with a paper trail, not with the cops already stopping by. Part of me thinks he's just avoiding them. It's what I would do, but..."
The phone. Ringing inside and no sign of Tyler.
"Right. The phone."
Jackson unlocked the main door, and the vestibule area felt claustrophobic, with the bar dark and locked to the side, and the narrow stairway, and the glass door streaked with dirt. He locked the door behind me and motioned for the stairs.
After you.
Our steps echoed in time, and the hall smelled faintly of cigarettes, and his hand brushed mine once on the railing. The floorboards creaked at the landing, and Jackson stood behind me, fidgeting with his phone. "Let me," I said. I took out my cell and called Tyler, keeping the phone by my side, pressing my ear to the door.
"You hear it?"
Jackson asked, leaning way too close. "Yeah, I hear it." I closed my eyes, straining to hear more. The slow and periodic drip of a faucet leak, the rattle of the air conditioning unit as it stirred to life, but no footsteps, no rustling of bedsheets, no call for help. "I don't hear him," I said.
"That's what I've been saying."
There's something distinctly different about being told someone is missing over the phone, or seeing signs stapled to trees or a picture on the news, and confirming it in person. Feeling the absence. It's a pinprick of discomfort that grows into a hollow terror. It's a void that gets filled with all the horrible possibilities existing all at once. I knocked on the door again, in the same way I'd checked the same places for Corinne over and over. Back to the caverns, wondering if there was a corner I'd forgotten, a room tucked out of sight. "Tyler, it's me," I called, my voice wavering with panic. "Tyler!" My fist was clenched when Jackson pulled it away from the door.
"Come on,"
he said, heading back downstairs to the bar. He led me through the empty bar to a storage room and grabbed a ladder. He carried it effortlessly out the door and around the back into the parking lot and situated it directly below Tyler's window.
"You're my alibi and I'm yours. We weren't breaking in. We were checking on him. Got it?"
We nodded at each other, sealing a pact. He checked the streets behind us, empty now. I put my hands on the rungs, but Jackson placed a hand on my shoulder.
"Me. I look like maintenance. You look like a pretty girl on a ladder. People won't question me."
I hated that he was right, because I wanted in that room. Needed to be the one to see with certainty that Tyler wasn't there. That the visions in my head of his lifeless body beside his ringing phone weren't real. That he was okay somewhere. I needed to see the phone and know why he left it. Look in his closet and know where he went. I watched as Jackson maneuvered the air conditioning unit and heaved himself inside along with it. I stared up, waiting, the glare of the sun off the top of the window making my eyes burn, the uncertainty making my breath hitch. Jackson leaned out the window.
"Empty,"
he called. He spent way too long trying to get the air unit back in. When he eventually came down, he folded up the ladder and wordlessly walked back inside. "What did you see? Where is he, do you know?" I asked, trailing behind him. I followed him all the way to the storage closet before he answered.
"Nah, didn't want to go through his shit. He's not there, that's all I know. Maybe he went camping or something."
Useless Jackson Porter. It should have been me. I would have checked for his sleeping bag and canteens. I would have looked for his toothbrush, scrolled through his phone, logged onto his computer and checked the search history. Or maybe Jackson did. Maybe he just didn't want to tell me. We stood in the middle of the empty bar, the stools on the counter, the panic in my chest slowly unraveling.
"Here,"
he said, taking down a stool.
"Let me make you breakfast. We can catch up."
I slid onto the stool, felt the adrenaline burning through the last of my energy, the crash just beginning. "Coffee," I said. "Strong." He kept the sign turned to close and kept the lights off, so all we had was the glare through the window. My eyes were adjusting to the dark. "You serve breakfast at a bar?"
"No,"
he said.
"I make breakfast for myself. We open at noon today. Still, if we turn the lights on, people will try."
"So much for a shitty economy."
"It's beyond shitty, Nick."
He cracked an egg, dumped it directly into a pan.
"It's great for business."
"Real nice, Jackson. Doesn't it feel like you're taking advantage?"
"It doesn't feel like anything, unless you think about it too much. Who am I to judge? Meanwhile, I've got the most stable job in the state."
"Good for you," I mumbled. He slid a sunny-side-up egg on a plate in front of me, and I poked it with my fork, the yolk bleeding out.
"What's the matter?"
he asked.
"Don't like eggs?"
I scooped some into my mouth, but it tasted wrong. Metallic somehow, just a little off. "Do you remember Hannah Pardoe?" I asked.
"Who?"
"You know, the woman from the state office who was investigating Corinne's disappearance." How could he not remember that?
"Oh, right. Detective Pardoe. I had no idea what her first name was."
"Wow.
She let you call her Hannah? God, she must have really liked you."
"No, she didn't. And now that he mentioned it, she never called herself Hannah, and I never called her that either. Yes, detective. No, detective. Thank you, detective. I'm sorry, detective. Yet I remembered her as Hannah Pardoe." "Hannah wants to speak with you, Nick." That had been my father standing just outside my door. "You don't have to, but I think you should. I already told Brix everything, so tell Hannah the same thing." That was my dad. "Thanks for your help, Hannah. He's a well-educated man, and he can recite lines of poetry, quote philosophy when the time is right. He's a widower just trying to get by. His son hit his daughter, and I listened to them speaking through the bathroom grate. Listen, Hannah. Can I call you Hannah? This is a family problem, that's all. I have a feeling that Corinne's might be a family problem, too. That girl was always here, trying to get away from something." My father was handsome in the way that professors sometimes are, with their mismatching suits and bow ties and penny loafers and hair that they don't bother styling. He had an easy smile and eyes that sparkled from the slight buzz he carried with him through the day. "I heard someone call her that," I told Jackson. "She didn't like me either."
"So what about her?"
he asked. "They're going to bring her in, or someone like her. And if we're all here, who do you think they'll go after?" He paused, scooped the rest of his breakfast into his mouth, chased it with half a glass of orange juice. He wiped his mouth with his bare hand.
"We should all go on a long trip."
I smiled. That wouldn't look suspicious at all. He took my plate and tossed them both into the sink, ran the water without looking at me.
"I want to tell you something. You don't have to say anything back."
"Okay." He focused on the running water, the way it hit the bottom of the silver bin.
"I didn't hurt Corinne. I loved her."
"I know," I said. He glanced up, and his look nearly crushed me. I picked up my glass so my hands would have something to do.
"The thing is, Nick, the baby wasn't mine."
I froze, my cup halfway to my mouth.
"Did Tyler tell you that?"
he pressed. "No," I said, barely any voice coming through.
"I don't know if he believed me when I told him. He was right, though. I couldn't say that. It'd still be a motive. Jealousy, right?"
I nodded, picturing Tyler and Jackson down by the river. "Be smart," he'd said.
"But I didn't know, Nick. I didn't even know. She didn't tell me. Why didn't she tell me?"
He put his hands on top of the bar right in front of me.
"We never had sex, Nick."
I felt my cheeks heating up, the cup turning slippery. "Okay." He shook his head, then looked back at me, out from under his long lashes.
"Do you believe me? Did she tell you that? Did she tell you who?"
"She didn't tell me anything," I said. "Jackson, this is what the cops want. They want us to start doubting again, to question each other, to drag it all out again. Let it go. Let her go." He turned the faucet off, his hands dripping as he held them.
"I can't. You know what she said to me that night?"
He'd seen her after the fair. I knew that. But this was the first time he was admitting to it, and I wasn't sure why.
"She begged me to take her back, and I said no. I said I was done with her, that I'd found someone else. I was so stupid, so stubborn. It never would have worked out anyway, not with Corinne around, not out in the open. I came second to Corinne for her, too."
"Bailey?" I asked. He pushed off the bar, leaned against the cabinet of liquor bottles.
"Corinne knew. I could tell. She told me she'd take me back, and I said no. She did it to herself, you know, the cuts on her back."
I nodded. I didn't know it then, but I did now.
God, I should have said yes. I think about that all the time. I was just some stupid kid. I should have said yes, and she'd be here still.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I trust you.
He stayed where he was, but his smile made him seem closer.
Because I'd never tell anyone how one night last week, Tyler comes back from a date, sits at the bar, and then your brother comes in and buys him around and asks him to please leave you alone in no uncertain terms. And then Tyler's phone rings, and he gets a big-ass smile and says to Dan, "You really should be having this talk with her." And he picks up the phone right there, right here, right in front of Dan like he's gloating. "Hey, Nick," he says, and then his face falls, and he tells you to calm down, and he leaves his drink on the bar and gets the hell out of here, and your brother follows a few minutes later. They both tear out of the parking lot on their way to you, and then Annalise goes missing.
My hands shook under the bar, my entire body on edge. "It's not..."
"I'm sure it's not,"
he said.
"But you know how shit gets around here. You hear a story like that, or like Corinne begging me to take her back when she's pregnant with someone else's kid. You say something like that, and it's over."
We were silent, pretending to go about our normal activities, like he hadn't both threatened and confided in me. And then I started to laugh. "I hate this place."
"You miss it,"
he said. "I miss it like an ex-con misses the other inmates. Like the ice after the fist. They come in pairs."
"Think you'll ever move back?"
"Never," I said. At Jackson's look, I added, "I'm getting married. To a guy in Philadelphia."
"Does Tyler know this?"
"Yes."
"But he's the one you called after midnight." "No, you're right. None of my business."
I caught a stanza of Poe heading up his forearm, a line from Kerouac slashed across his wrist, as though he had mined my father's old books, borrowed words and hidden beneath them. "I gotta go. Thanks for breakfast."
"It was good to see you, Nick."
I stopped at the door, turned to see Jackson still watching me. "She's dead, Jackson," I said.
"I know,"
he said. I drove by Tyler's parents' place on the way back. His truck wasn't there either. For all the time we spent together, I didn't know them well. Tyler wasn't the type to bring a girlfriend home for dinner. We stayed indoors only in bad weather. We always had his truck, and there were the woods. On first glance, it may seem like there's nothing to do here. But honestly, the world is yours. And the woods were ours. The clearing where we'd set up a tent, the caverns if we were with friends, and the river. We spent a lot of time down near the river, lying on our backs, fingers loosely linked. The river cut between our homes, which now seemed more metaphorical than physical. I could get to Tyler's from my own place if not for the river. Technically, it was possible to cross in the narrow section on one of the trees someone had dragged across, but it was out of the way and tricky in the dark. One misstep and you were over. The water cooler than you expected, the rocks sharper, the night indifferent to your plight. No, it was much better to take his truck to the drugstore and go from there. Much shorter, too. I passed that drugstore on the way back home, and then the elementary school, the police station, the church, and the graveyard. I felt myself getting lightheaded at the stoplight, holding my breath until the light turned green. I didn't go in my house or the garage. I'd accidentally left the door ajar when I'd left with Jackson in a hurry. I trekked out to the hill behind my house, looking down into the valley, imagining all the possibilities that could have happened out there. The Carter property was to my side, beyond the dried-up creek bed. I could see a sliver of white from the remodeled garage in the distance, the river farther in the distance, now hidden. In the winter, when the leaves fell, and depending on the angle, you could catch a glimpse. Now all you could hear was the low, steady rumble. We could hear it more after a few days of rain. I used to find Daniel up here sometimes, though I'd thought this spot was mine alone. My haunts, my places, probably belonged to every child who ever lived here. Annalise must have sat here too, surveying her world. She must have stumbled upon the clearing with the fort that I thought belonged to us. She must have known all the paths through the woods, all the places to hide, just as I did. I followed the one I knew best, the one that cut a straight path to the clearing. I used to think the downtrodden underbrush, the exposed dirt, was from the wear of my steps and Daniel's over time, but it probably was begun years earlier and would continue years after. There was the tree with the hole in the trunk. I stuck my hand in, pulled out a few acorns and a collection of stones we'd stored there years earlier. There was the spot in the corner, the flattest surface where Tyler and I would pitch his tent. There was the joint between two trunks where Daniel and I collected long branches in case we needed to ward off outsiders. Corinne and Bailey and I took over the clearing once, way before boys, when we were still made for play, and tried to make Daniel and his friends earn it back. Corinne had raised a big stick over her head, pretending to be the Lord of the Rings wizard, which the boys had been watching in the living room. It became this big event, me and Corinne and Bailey guarding the site, Daniel and his friends trying to sneak inside without getting caught, and Corinne's booming voice, "You shall not pass," disintegrating into a fit of laughter. We'd played until it was dark, and Corinne tried to get them to declare their loyalty to her as queen of the clearing, waving the stick in front of her body, swishing her hips in a rhythm. Eventually, Daniel swung Corinne over his shoulder. She was skinny and straight, her hair nearly brushed the ground, and she was yelling, "A curse on you, Daniel Farrell," because she was Corinne Prescott even back then. I could feel them surrounding me here before things changed, like the past was alive, existing right beside the present. Daniel abandoned this place first, always responsible, too mature, no time for kid stuff. Corinne and Bailey didn't want to hang out here by themselves. "It's only fun if someone's trying to fight you for it," Corinne said. "Otherwise, what's the point?" I tried to hold the memory of all the people who had been here with me. Daniel and Tyler, Corinne and Bailey. And then I tried to imagine an outsider watching us all. All those times we used to scare ourselves with sounds. An animal, the breeze, a monster, Daniel had said, and we had rolled our eyes. "Nothing," Tyler had said, pulling me closer in the tent. "I got you." But what if there were something? What if the monster were a child just watching? What if it were Annalise crouched in the bushes? I tried to make myself small, make myself timid, make myself her, and see our lives playing out through her eyes. What did she see, I wondered? What did she think? Who was I through the filter of her eyes? I stood, wandering to the center of the clearing, trying to picture us. I was so caught up in the memories of other people, the feeling of people sharing this space with me, that at first I didn't recognize the feeling of someone real, someone now. The crack of a twig and the shuffling of underbrush, the hairs raising on the back of my neck in response. I was in the middle of the clearing, completely exposed, and I felt eyes. I was sure I could hear breathing. "Tyler?" I called. I hated that he was always my first instinct, the number I'd start dialing after midnight and then stop, the name I'd call when I heard a front door creak open. "Annalise?" I called in a voice just above a whisper. I took out my cell phone so if there were someone, he or she would see I had it. Sounds, footsteps, from just out of sight, from deeper in the woods. I backed away into the trees, closer to home, heard something from the side, and spun in that direction. I held the phone in both hands, and I had a signal. A beautiful signal out in the woods, with the one service provider who covered out here. Terrible plan otherwise, couldn't get a break on mobile-to-mobile. The data service part was murky at best, but I was alone in the woods, and it worked. Everett had taken my phone once while he was in the other room charging. He tried to look up the scores of a game, got frustrated, and said,
"Why do you have this service? It's horrible."
"It's not horrible," I'd said, but it was. Now I thought, because, just in case, for this, for here. I thought of all the little things I'd held on to, all the little things I'd taken with me when I left, a fine, transparent thread leading all the way home. I held the phone to my ear, and I called the one person I knew would come, no questions asked. The phone rang 2, 3 times, and I was teetering on the brink of panic when Daniel picked up. "I'm in the woods," I said, "at the clearing."
"Okay,"
he said.
"Are you okay?"
The faint wafting of a scent on the breeze. Cigarette smoke, gone as suddenly as it had registered. "I don't know," I said. My hand on the tree trunk with the hole, the bark rough and familiar, grounding me. I could hear the panic in his breathing, imagined him pushing himself to standing.
"What's wrong?"
he asked. My eyes roamed the woods, looking for the source. I lowered my voice. "I don't know. I feel like someone's here." I heard him curse under his breath.
"I'm coming. Stay on the phone with me. Make it known that you're on the phone. Be loud, Nick, and walk straight for home."
It would take him 20 minutes to get here if he were home, longer if he were on site somewhere. I had no idea what to talk about and ended up sharing the most idiotic thing I could imagine. "I'm thinking about eloping. Something totally vacant. I can't stand the idea of a big wedding. All these people I don't know. Everett's family knows everyone. There will probably be 200 people from his side and 5 from mine. And Dad, what if that day he doesn't know who I am? What if he won't walk me down the aisle? Or maybe we should have a destination wedding, just family, somewhere warm."
"Where are you?"
he asked. "Yeah, I'm on the trail. There's this cool oak tree. You remember it?" I picked up a sharp rock off the path, spun in a quick circle, heard a noise to my left, a crackling of leaves. I kept moving, with more purpose now.
"I hear you," he said.
"If Everett's family insists on a wedding, I guess I'd have Olivia. She works with Everett, and Laura, of course, if she wants, and probably Arden from college. I couldn't think of any other names. Keep it small, you know? Meaningful."
"Keep talking,"
Daniel said.
"I'm on Fulton Road."
I kept moving, kept talking, and had no idea whether someone was still here, still following. Daniel and I didn't talk about personal stuff, about anything that wasn't an essential conversation anymore. If he called, it was for a reason. If I called, it was to give him a new address, to tell him my Christmas plans, to let him know I got engaged. I once went to this wedding when I was interning for an ex-student's parents. It was so weird. The dad was getting remarried, and the son asked me to come. It was probably totally inappropriate now that I think of it. An 18-year-old bringing a 23-year-old teacher as a date. But I didn't think of it like that at the time. It was in the summer, right after he graduated, and it wasn't like a date. It was just like he got me on the invite list. I thought he was trying to tell me something. Anyway, the wedding was ridiculous. Those people were beyond rich, Daniel. Like, rich is an understatement. A wedding that could pay for college, that could feed a small country. I don't know why he brought me. I don't know what he wanted me to see. I don't know where he is now.
Cranston Lane now. Do you see anyone?
I spun around again, but couldn't get a sense of where the feeling was coming from. No, I feel like I should look him up and ask him. I had this other kid later who told me I just had to see his football game. I was there anyway. We have to work a certain number of games each semester. But he didn't care about me seeing him play, really. He was showing me something. His father laying into him after the game. The pressure. He didn't want to say it, right? Sometimes it's easier to show.
Where are you?
I checked over my shoulder, but my vision was going a little hazy from the adrenaline, or maybe the panic. Oh, I'm almost home now. I need to call that kid. Shane something. God, I can't even remember his last name. I've been to his father's wedding and I can't remember his name? They all start blending together. There are just too many of them. Hey, I can see our house.
Nick, get in the house and lock the doors.
I did. I dropped the rock and ran, the phone cutting through the air with each pump of my arms. I ran the remaining distance between the woods and the house, slamming the door behind me and turning the lock like Daniel had said. I'm inside, I said, out of breath, walking to the kitchen window, staring into the woods. I couldn't see anything. No sign of life.
You're okay?
I'm inside, I repeated, my hand over my heart. Slow down.
Stay in the house,
he said.
I'm here.
His blue SUV pulled all the way to the garage, and I watched him exit the driver's side, but he didn't walk toward the house. He went straight for the woods. I ran out front again. "Daniel, what the hell are you doing?"
"Stay inside, Nick."
He started jogging away from me. Like hell. I wasn't about to stay in the house while he went into the woods I'd just run out of in a panic. I walked back to the edge of the woods and stood outside the tree line, trying to keep my breathing quiet and measured. I watched him disappear in fragments, a sliver of him sliding behind that tree, an arm lost to a branch, his footsteps to the wind. I kept my eyes focused on the spot where he'd disappeared, willing him to return. I waited, my breathing growing louder, my pulse gaining speed, and jumped at the phone ringing in my hand. Everett. I hit the silence button and immediately heard footsteps coming closer. "Daniel?" I whispered, craning my neck to get a better view, and then louder. "Daniel?" I saw a shock of blonde hair first, then a shoulder, half a face, his long, lanky legs. He came out shaking his head, tucking something in the back of his pants.
"Didn't see anyone," he said.
"Is that a gun?" He didn't answer, kept moving toward the house, expecting me to keep up.
"Are you sure you heard someone?"
he asked. "Why the hell do you have a gun?"
"Because we live in the middle of nowhere and it takes the cops too long to get to the house. Everyone has a gun."
"No, not everyone. That can't be safe, just walking around with it tucked inside your pants." He held the door for me, waited until we were inside, and took a deep breath.
"Nick, are you sure? Tell me exactly what you heard."
I couldn't meet his eyes. I was at the clearing, the one where we used to make forts, and I thought I heard footsteps. I strained to hear in my memory, but I felt like I was forcing it, making the leaves crunch, turning up the volume. I thought I smelled someone smoking, but I'm not sure. Maybe someone was watching me, but maybe there wasn't. Like Daniel said, there's a monster out there. It's not too much of a stretch when you haven't been sleeping enough, when you've just been threatened, when the people you love have disappeared. It's not too hard to believe in monsters here.
"Maybe you should have figured that out before you called, scaring the shit out of me."
I glared at him. I was scared. He did that deep breathing technique, trying not to explode at me. I felt my shoulders tightening, like his did when he was tense.
"Your eyes are all bloodshot. Have you been sleeping?"
he asked. I could tell he didn't quite trust me. As the time grew between then and now, I didn't quite trust myself either. "A little. I can't really," I said. "I can't sleep here."
"I told you to come stay with us, Nick. Come stay with us."
I started to laugh, because that would solve everything, right? "When did you get the gun, Daniel?" He picked at the pile of receipts on the table, narrowing his eyes, putting them back where they'd been.
"Laura told me what happened at the shower. She feels terrible. Let her take care of you. She's driving me crazy."
"And how would you explain that? Why I suddenly want to stay?"
"Air conditioning,"
he said, the side of his mouth quirking up for a second. "I can't, Daniel. Besides, and no offense, but Laura is really nosy." He shook his head but didn't argue.
"Listen, I have to be on site tomorrow, but I'll swing by in the morning to check on you. If you can't reach me, you know you can call Laura. She can handle it."
"Right."
"You don't give her enough credit, Nick."
I saw the outline of the gun as he walked away. "It's a family trait," I called after him, but he shook his head and kept moving. "Daniel?" He stopped, spun around. "Thank you for coming." He turned back around and waved an acknowledgement as he walked away. At the car, he rested his arms on top of it.
"Did you get the affidavits?"
"One for two," I said, working on the other one. He nodded.
"The gun was Dad's," he said. "I didn't think it was safe for him to have it anymore. I took it from him so he wouldn't hurt himself. Or someone else."
So we had a father who drank too much. So he didn't come home sometimes. So he forgot to get groceries. So he left us to our own devices. We were lucky. In the grand scheme of life, 10 years later, I could see. We were lucky.